let me ask you a question as we begin this morning, friends. Is it possible in our day and age to speak openly about the concept of wickedness? Is it possible in our day and age to speak openly about the concept of wickedness? Or is it an idea that has become altogether antiquated, beyond which our culture has moved? In our conversations with the people that you meet, the people that you work with, the people in your neighborhood, the parents of the children who play with your children, in our conversations with the people we meet every day, is it wise for us to presuppose the existence of objective evil? If you are an intelligent postmodernist, that is, if the formative influence of your life has been secular Western culture from about the mid-1970s forward, it wouldn't surprise me in the least if you were hesitant to answer my question in the affirmative. In fact, the question itself may seem a little bit over the top to you. Is there such a thing as real, objective, universal, transhistorical wickedness? Wickedness that is truly wickedness in every day and time, in every place. Dr. Mark Dever is the pastor of Capitol Hill Baptist Church in Washington, D.C., just a few moments from the Supreme Court building. And he tells the story, Dr. Dever does, of a woman who, for anonymity's sake, we'll call Claudia. A woman in her 50s now, a powerful mover and shaker in the Washington political scene. Up until her conversion, she had been a dyed-in-the-wool, staunch, hard-nosed, self-conscious, highly intelligent postmodernist. She believed, as a functional atheist, that the very notions of good and evil are social constructs. That is to say, at the end of the day, in reality, there is no such thing as good and evil. That the concepts of good and evil are constructs imposed upon our culture by the dominant people or religious group. And so in the upper echelons of postmodernism, you'll hear things like, well, the Holocaust? Well, obviously, it was pretty awful from the point of the view of the Jews, but from the point of the view of the Aryan supremacists, the only problem with the Holocaust is that it didn't go far enough. It all depends upon your point of view, because at the end of the day, right and wrong are social constructs. And 9/11, there are postmodernists who have written to this effect. From the point of the view of the people in the towers, it was not a happy day. But from the point of view of the Muslims around the world, it was a glorious day of triumph, an expression of great courage. It all depends upon your point of view, doesn't it? Because there was no right or wrong. No wickedness, no righteousness. Those are social constructs. That was how Claudia believed. In due course, this woman was posted to Papua New Guinea for a short time on a political assignment. And just as she was concluding her work there, a priest was arrested. After 35 years of missionary service, it had surfaced that he had raped over 200 young boys. And Claudia, intelligent woman that she was, began to think through all the implications of this. For the lives of those boys, for their children, for their children's children, because, as you well know, the abused often become the abusers. It was a horrendous thing. The network of this was going to be phenomenal, but she couldn't call it evil, you see. She couldn't call it wicked because there is no such thing as evil. There is no such thing as wicked. It all depends on your point of view. It's a social construct, a cultural category. So she came home and she told her neighbor, Dr. Mark Dever, about it. And he asked her point blank, Claudia, what the priest did, was it wicked? And she said, oh, come on, Mark. What are you, a Neanderthal? Wicked. wicked. There's no such thing as wicked. You know how it works. You're an intelligent man. The abusers are often the abused. Truth be told, that priest was probably more a victim than a perpetrator. To which Deborah replied, well, I'm not denying that sin is social. The Bible itself teaches that. Sins of the fathers passed on to the third and fourth generation of the children with a network of implications. I understand that, not denying that. But Claudia, what I'm asking you directly is this. Was the act itself wicked? In fact, every time he saw Claudia, to hear him tell it, whether he was walking past her on the street or he would see her in neighborhood stores, he would say, hi, Claudia. Was it wicked? And by it began to keep her up at night. To hear her tell it, she would wake up at all hours. Was it wicked? One particular night, she awoke in a cold sweat, drenched in perspiration, sat up in her bed and said out loud in the darkness, this was wicked. This was evil. And then it dawned on her. If there really is an objective category for evil, then maybe she was evil too. And it was the beginning of Claudia's conversion to Jesus Christ. The fact of the matter is, my friends, it is how every person becomes a Christian, ultimately. It's by recognizing that wickedness is not a social construct imposed upon us by our culture. It is nothing less than an act of rebellion against the holy and righteous God who made you. It's by recognizing that the gospel of Jesus Christ, the good news, is not for people who are, at the end of the day, essentially good, but for people who are fundamentally evil, and in fact they come to Jesus Christ because they know this to be true of themselves. You must not stumble at this point, beloved. You must not blush at this, because as long as you do, it is for certain that you will never become a Christian. Understanding God's great work of salvation in Jesus Christ is dependent upon your appreciation and acceptance of the objective reality of human wickedness and evil. Moreover, it is the only way you will ever be able to happily embrace God's great work of judgment, which is the very thing demanded by the text that is before us this morning. This fourth movement in this great oratorio of doom, its theme is simple. It's expressed in the very first word, rejoice. It's a call for God's people to rejoice. And you say, to rejoice at what? Well, the answer is obvious. To rejoice at the judgment of God. You say, we're to rejoice at the execution of God's judgment? Absolutely. I told you, dear friends, back when we were in Revelation chapter 4, that the book of Revelation has more music contained in it than any other book in all the Bible except for the Psalter. And three themes make up the music in the book of Revelation. The theme of creation, the theme of salvation, and the theme of judgment. We've seen hymns to God in honor of His creative work. We've seen hymns to God in response to His saving work. Here we come now, friends, to worship directed to God in music, exalting His judicial work. And the justification for doing so presupposes the existence of human wickedness. This movement unfolds very simply in three parts. The exhortation itself, which is verse 20. A subsequent illustration with its interpretation, that's verses 21, 22, and the first part of verse 23. And finally, the justification for this judgment, the latter half of verse 23 and verse 24. So let's look, first of all, at the exhortation itself, the exhortation proper, as it were. Verse 20, rejoice over her, that is, over burning, smoldering Babylon. Rejoice over her, O heaven, you saints and apostles and prophets, for God has given judgment for you against her. Now, friends, the most obvious thing at the outset of this movement is its tone. in that it is so radically different from what has immediately preceded it. Remember the tone of the prior movement? Verses 9 and 10. And the kings of the earth, who committed fornication and lived in luxury with her, will weep and wail over her when they see the smoke of her burning. They will stand far off in fear of her torment and say, "Alas, alas, the great city." Verse 15. The merchants of these wares who gained wealth from her will stand far off in fear of her torment, weeping and mourning aloud. There it is again. Alas, alas, the great city. Verse 19. All the people who earned their living by way of transporting these goods to Babylon, they threw dust on their heads as they wept and mourned, crying aloud, "Alas, alas, the great city." You see, friends, a consistent response marks the various people groups of this world order as they witness the effects of the judgment of God. They mourn, they grieve, they're filled with compassion. It's certainly not rejoicing, nor is it, as I would have you take note, nor is there any expression of repentance. It's great emotional distress and despair. After all, the source of their luxury has been destroyed. Moreover, the text says they look on in dread, in terror, because having committed fornication with this world system, they know they're next. This response to God's judgment, however, is the very opposite. It's a happy thing. It's a joyous thing. It is a command to exuberant jubilation. It's a call to celebration. Let's ask of it three brief questions. Firstly, who declares this exhortation? Remember the first movement? Back in verse 1. It was sung by an angel, a great and glorious angel, reflecting the very brilliance and splendor of God Himself. The second movement, beginning in verse 4, was sung by Jesus Christ. The third movement, it was sung by the political power brokers, the merchandising magnates, the transportation community, as it were. Now, we know from verse 21... that a mighty angel sings the remainder of this movement. But what about the exclamation itself in verse 20? I take it, dear friends, to be the exclamation of the Apostle John himself. After all, if you remember, this entire business began when an angel promised to show John the judgment of Babylon. "Come, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot." And John, you must understand, dear friends, for him, this was no glimpse of some impersonal, irrelevant prophetic event, something in the future about which he was detached, about which he could be coolly academic and dispassionate. John and his followers had staked their lives on the gospel of Jesus Christ. For them, then, commitment to Jesus Christ was not merely a theoretical issue, it was an existential issue. John has now been exiled to the island of Patmos. Some of his friends have been put into prison. Others have been martyred. The churches that he so dearly loves, infested with false teachers, promoting compromise with Babylon. All of it is breaking his heart. And so when he is given to see the smoldering embers of Babylon's ruins, he's overcome with emotion and he exclaims triumphantly, "Rejoice!" With all of his apostolic authority inspired by the Spirit of God, he issues forth this command, "Rejoice!" It is what we call a present imperative. It's a command that is to be obeyed ceaselessly. Keep on continually rejoicing. But that raises a second brief question. To whom is this command addressed? To whom is it addressed? Look at what the text tells us. "Rejoice over her, O heaven, you saints and apostles and prophets." Now, friends, the idea here is not that he's referring to the inhabitants of heaven. Oh, heaven, that is, saints, apostles, and prophets who are in heaven, The idea here is all the inhabitants of heaven and all of God's people on the earth. Saints, apostles, prophets. All of God's people celestially, all of God's people terrestrially. All of God's people in heaven and on earth. Why belabor this? So that you will see, dear friends, that quite practically and quite personally, this is a command issued to you. You are here. Oh, but I'm too compassionate to rejoice at the judgment of God. Always be wary of people whose compassions are greater than God's. This includes you. This is our song. We are commanded, beloved, to relentlessly rejoice over God's judicial destruction of Babylon. Which brings us then to a third question. Why is this rejoicing commanded of us? I mean, it sounds rather barbaric, don't you think? Kind of bloodthirsty? Spitefully? Gleefully? Vindictive? Why rejoice? He tells us. For God has given judgment for you against her. Now that's a very difficult phrase to translate from Greek into English. Literally it reads, because God judged your judgment from her. This is built on a very, very important Old Testament law that has often been referred to as the law of a dishonest or the law of false witness. And the idea is this. If I take you to court, lie about you in court so that a certain affliction is poured down on you because of my false witness, and I am then proved to be a liar, then the judgment I wanted to be poured out upon you is to be poured out upon me. Okay? That's the underpinning to this. You have to understand that this verse here carries with it a courtroom kind of context. It carries with it a kind of forensic flavor. The idea, friends, is that Babylon had repeatedly judged Christians to be guilty and thus shed their blood. You get in the way of Babylon, you're persecuted, you're killed, you're destroyed, you're eradicated. Babylon does everything she can to eradicate her enemies. And throughout time, Babylon has repeatedly judged the people of God to be guilty, thus shed their blood. But now you see the case has come to the final court of appeal, to the very bar of God himself, and he has overturned Babylon's verdict. And thus imposed upon her the very sentence she had passed on Christians. And what sentence was that? Look over at verse 24. And in you, that is in Babylon, was found the blood of prophets and of saints and of all who have been slaughtered on earth. You've judged God's people to be guilty. You've shed their blood. God has now overturned that verdict and poured out upon you the judgment you demanded and executed upon them. It's just another way of saying, beloved, what Jesus himself said earlier. Remember in verse 6? Render to her as she herself is rendered. Repay her a duplicate for her deeds. Mix her an equivalent draft in the cup she mixed. Why does Jesus command us to rejoice? Not because, my friends, he is driven by a selfish spirit of revenge. Oh, now, finally, we'll get our pound of flesh. No. It's because this judgment of God against Babylon ultimately displays his righteousness in that it shows his people to be in the right and the verdict rendered against them by this ungodly world to be wrong. Now, the exhortation gives way to an illustration and its interpretation. Verse 21. Then a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea. Some of you have been to Koinonia Conference Grounds. We used to take retreats there. I used to go there as a little boy, and some time ago, years ago, there were a group of us who, I don't know if we actually invented it or copied it from someone else, but we made these water balloon launchers. We got long pieces of surgical tubing, and we got a funnel and cut holes in it and run the surgical tubing through it, and stood at the pillars that are in front of the cafeteria there at Koinonia. One guy would wrap one end around one pillar, and 10 or 15 feet over here, the other end would be wrapped around, and somebody in the center would take that thing and stretch it back, and we'd put a water balloon in that funnel. And we'd pull it back as far as we could and let it go. And that water balloon would just whiz through the air at unbelievable speed. One night, some of us got out there in the dark where we couldn't see, running around. We were stupid, because if one of those things hit us in the head, it would kill us. We actually broke a girl's leg a couple of days later doing that, unintentionally, of course. But we would be there out in the middle of the night in pitch black, and all we would hear was zoom. Just that's the idea behind the imagery here. Notice that in this acted out parable, this millstone is not dropped into the sea, nor does it merely fall into the sea. It is violently hurled into the sea. In fact, the word in the next phrase, the word translated in my translation, violence, literally means a whizzing through the air. It's not dropped. It's hurled, which tells you that what you're about to see is not accidental. It's intentional. It speaks of its suddenness and its great violence. Moreover, notice John draws our attention to something of its great size. Notice, it is a stone like a great millstone. It's a massive boulder, typically in this culture, 4 to 5 feet in diameter, 1 foot thick, weighing thousands of pounds. It was turned by oxen to grind grain. Now, why does John draw our attention to its size and perhaps the implication of its great weight? It's quite simple, friends. It's to graphically illustrate the impossibility of Babylon's rising from the depths of this sea of judgment in which she is submerged. No possibility of recovery exists. Now, listen to the angel's interpretation. With such violence whizzing through the air, Babylon, the great city, will be thrown down and will be found no more. Like a massive millstone embedded deeply in the ocean's floor, never to resurface. So Babylon will never again come back to life. In fact, we'll come back to this in just a moment. But in the Greek text, that very last line, the Greek uses a double negative for emphasis. Now, if we do that in English, people say, oh, this person speaks with bad grammar. But literally it reads, will not be found in her no more. The closest thing we could get to decent English would be something like this. Will be found no more in her at all. Will be found no more in her ever again. Now let me ask you, friends, what happens when you throw a great boulder into a body of water? It produces ripples that gradually fade until that water dies down to a flat calm, leaving no evidence of that boulder's prior existence. And that now is what this is. The stone sinks beneath the surface, and Babylon is as though it never existed. The entire anti-Christian world order is hurled into the sea, and by and by, look at it now, the sights and sounds of everyday life disappear. Notice the sounds of leisure and entertainment disappear. Verse 22, and the sound of harpists and minstrels, in all probability that refers to singers, and of flutists and trumpeters, will be heard in you no more. And that is another one of those double negatives. Will be heard in you no more at all. Notice the sounds of industry and business disappear. And an artisan of any trade will be found in you no more. Double negative. At all. The sound of the millstone will be heard in you no more at all. The sounds of leisure and entertainment, gone. The sounds of industry and business, gone. The sounds of home life and human relationships altogether disappear. And the light of a lamp will shine in you no more at all. And the voice of bridegroom and bride will be heard in you no more at all. Even in this pagan world, beloved, God's common grace allows for affection and intimacy and love in human relationships. All of it, gone, silenced, eradicated. The giant millstone? What stone? The ripples have stopped. It is a silencing of all of life. And friends, like a bell that tolls, marking out a person's death, we hear of the finality of it all in a phrase that rings out seven times, interestingly enough. Remember verse 21? Babylon will be thrown down and we'll be found no more at all. Verse 22, with regard to the musicians, the entertainers, will be heard in you no more at all. In response to the artisans, will be found in you no more at all. The sound of the millstone, heard in you no more at all. The light of a lamp will shine in you no more at all. The voice of bridegroom and bride will be heard in you no more at all. Seven times, double negatives, suggesting the finality of God's great judgment. And I want to tell you, you know what makes this so amazing? Is that every other scene in the book of Revelation where judgment is going on, it's always unbelievably loud. Remember? Thunder, lightning, great earthquakes. What makes this so ominous is its absolute silence, as though it never existed. Seven times, no more at all. It is God's response to the boast of Babylon herself. Remember? Remember verse 7? As she glorified herself and lived luxuriously, so give her a like measure of torment and grief, since in her heart she says, I rule as a queen, I am no widow, and I will never see grief. In the Greek text there, she speaks in a double negative. I will never, ever, in any way, know grief. God responds to her arrogance with a sevenfold reply using the very same language. No more at all. For all the power of her great economic allure, she is gone, as evidenced, beloved, by overpowering silence. The poet T.S. Eliot says it like this. This is how the world ends. This is how the world ends. This is how the world ends. Not with a bang, but a whimper. All of which then brings us to the justification. the justification for this devastating act of judgment, and subsequently the justification for the command to us to rejoice. In fact, you'll notice three reasons are given to justify this judgment. All of these, no more at all, no more at all. Why? For, reason number one, your merchants were the magnates of the earth. Literally it reads, the great ones. But why is that a reason for judgment? Simply because they're great? Well, beloved, as I told you the very first week we started chapter 18, all of these phrases from this oratorio of doom are taken from Old Testament oratorios of doom. And this one is taken from Isaiah chapter 23, when what is being mourned is the destruction of that great economic power, the city of Tyre. And this line right here is taken right from Isaiah chapter 23, where we read of the great ones having been destroyed. There in Isaiah called the princes or the honored of the earth. And you discover as you read Isaiah 23 that the reason why they are judged is not simply because they possessed wealth, but because their wealth had become the basis of their own self-glorification. They were destroyed for their self-idolatry. The chief end of humanity? It's Don's favorite line, isn't it? It's to glorify God. That's the message of the Bible. And beloved, it's the message of the Revelation. I mean, if we've learned anything in recent weeks, it's that God will not have any other gods exist. No competitors. The chief end of humanity is to glorify God, who in the absolute sense is the only truly great one. Instead, Babylon, however, interpreted her material prosperity as a manifestation of her own inherent greatness and thus forgot God. It is, beloved, the greatest of sins. Never forget this. Idolatry is. Meriting the most severe judgment. To make oneself the center of everything. To make oneself the center of the universe. It is the predominant spirit of our own age. Is it not? Arrogant self-glorification. Arrogant self-idolatry. The ultimate in humanism, right? Man the measure. It's the first reason for this ultimate judgment. The idolatry of themselves. Their own power and greatness and wealth. Notice the second reason for this judgment. And, or better yet, in the original, for all nations were deceived by your sorcery. This judgment is legitimized because Babylon had deceived the nations. But what's in view here, beloved, you must understand, is not the actual practice of magic, but the allure of Babylon's wealth that had bewitched people. Remember her golden cup held out in her hand, filled with abominations? All the nations of the earth had drunk from that golden cup and become intoxicated by its contents. Chapter 17, chapter 18, we've seen it again and again. Babylon's wealth had bewitched people into believing, you see, that their ultimate security could be found in the affluence that she promised, rather than in God, rather than in His gospel. This sorcery is Babylon's magic spell that plays, you see, to the susceptibilities of human beings inherently greedy for economic gain. Well, this beguiling of human beings will merit God's most severe judgment. The idolatry here of wealth. Why this severe judgment? Their own self-glorification, idolatry of self. Secondly, their deception of the nations, Babylon's deception of the nations and of people, the idolatry of its wealth that draws people in. And finally, notice the third reason. It is arguably the most important of all because it's what began verse 20. And in you, that is in Babylon, was found the blood of prophets and of saints and of all who have been slaughtered on the earth. Friends, how is Babylon's nature characterized back in chapter 17, verse 6? Remember? And I saw that the woman was drunk with the blood of the saints and the blood of the witnesses to Jesus. My friends, I've never been a soldier, never been associated with the military. But it seems to me that if there was any ambiguity in the minds of United States soldiers during World War II, ambiguity regarding the invasion of Europe, ambiguity regarding war in general, I can only assume that it would have all instantly evaporated when they walked through those barbed wire gates of Auschwitz and Treblinka and Buchenwald. And they came across those ovens and the showers with their Cyclone B and the mass graves. Suddenly, the rightness of war became self-evident. That's what this is, magnified a million times. In you was found the blood of prophets and of saints and of all who have been slaughtered on earth. The idea is all those in history who have been persecuted because of their loyalty to the true God. My friends, the imagery here is as old as the earliest chapters of the Bible. It takes us back to the Cain and Abel story. Cain learned that he couldn't hide his murder. He couldn't hide his evil because the blood of his murdered brother cried out to God for vengeance. And it is that old Semitic idea you see that is here. The idea is the entire earth is a giant altar on which all of the blood of God's people has been poured. And here, not just one, but they all cry out as a crier of Abel's. Remember chapter 6, verse 10, from underneath the altar, demanding to know, how long will it be, O God, until you avenge our blood on the inhabitants of the earth? And from chapter 6 through this point in the Revelation, God's integrity is on the line. The integrity of His justice, and more to the point here, the integrity of His love. These are His people, people with whom God is in covenant relationship. And they have suffered for their allegiance to Him. This is why John calls us to rejoice. Because the character of God, held in question up to this point, is now revealed to be what it always has been. Never unjust. Never unrighteous. Not indifferent. The fact of the matter is you do not mess with the apple of God's eye and live to talk about it. God may not pay at the end of every day, but in the end He pays. Whoever has harmed you, beloved, whoever has spoken evilly against you, beloved, for the sake of the gospel, will face this wrath of God on the great and final day. Vengeance is mine. I will repay, says the Lord. It's why we don't have to retaliate. It's why, like Jesus, we bear our greatest witness when we suffer, when we're spoken against, and when, if necessary, we're slaughtered. the justification for this judgment, and our subsequent rejoicing? Three reasons. Self-glorification, deception, persecution, all of which, in the end, amount to idolatry. Is there such a thing as wickedness? Yes. Is there such a thing as divine judgment upon wickedness? Yes. And am I suggesting this morning that the only proper response to such judgment is rejoicing? Yes. Which makes me realize something I don't think I'd ever realized until now. Our response to divine judgment reveals who we really are and what we really prize. How you respond to passages like this will tell you more about yourself than just about anything else in all the Bible. So let me ask you, are you like the kings, the merchants, the seafaring people who mourn with sadness in response to God's judgment? Or do you love righteousness enough to rejoice in sin's final destruction? You know what, friends? As a people, and by this I don't even necessarily mean we who are Christians gathered in this place. I mean we who are a part of this world and this culture. We have grown to love moral ambiguity. I mean, it used to be back in the 50s that the good guys always wore the white hats. And that the bad guys were always easily identifiable because they always wore the black hats. But now, even our heroes are conflicted. Even Batman and Spider-Man have a dark side. And maybe we like this because as fallen human beings, somehow we instinctively know that even the best of human beings are conflicted. I agree with that wholeheartedly. It's true. It's reality. But we must not foist that ambiguity upon God. The ambiguity within us, the conflict within us, beloved, is not the result of being created in the image of God. It's a result of being born fallen. Therefore, if we blush at his execution of final judgment rather than rejoice, ours is not a compassion that has been shaped by the glory of God, but a sentimentality that has grown too tender toward wickedness. An attitude that lacks passion for the righteousness of God. Beware of compassion that is greater than God's. You are not more compassionate than God. You will never be more compassionate of God. If you bless at this, it's not because you're compassionate, it's because you're wicked. And me too. The fact is, we all blush at this. How would you like to have your neighbor sitting next to you this morning as we talk through this passage? Or your coworker? It'd embarrass you, wouldn't it? It embarrassed me. And that tells me everything about myself that I didn't want to know. These things hang together. A proper estimation of wickedness will eagerly affirm the necessity of judgment. To the contrary, the extent that you diminish the first is the extent to which you will wince at the second. And here's why it should concern you this morning. If you devalue wickedness and you blush at judgment, you will never, ever understand the reason for the cross. where wickedness and judgment collide in Jesus Christ. To the contrary, my friends, if you truly value what Jesus Christ accomplished on the cross, then I can tell you this. On the great and final day, in the fullness of your glorified state, all you will want to do is worship Him for His judgment of people who stubbornly refuse the cross, because then on that day you'll understand that anything less than unrestrained praise would be nothing but an insult of His great work. This is what righteous people will want to do. And for all of our ambivalence now, and for all of the conflict inside of us now, on that day, there will be none. We will see the cross and all of its positive benefits. And all of its negative benefits. Perfectly justified. Would you bow your heads with me, please?